It is Saturday, February 12th, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today we're having a special guest, David Eric Nelson, to talk about Snip, Burn, Solder, Shred, his book about making things. In the first half of the show, of course, we will do geek news.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today we're not taking calls. Instead, we're going to have a special guest on, talk about his book, Snip, Burn, Solder, Shred, Seriously Geeky Stuff to Make with Your Kids. David Nelson will join us via Skype in the second half. The first half, of course, we're going to be doing geek news. Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses, tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specializes in protecting data and have been providing data, storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. The Geek Speak theme song today is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. Thank you, Michael. If you'd like to participate on Geek Speak by making some art, please feel free to give us a theme song. We'll play it on air and give you a thanks. We also take imagery for our website. Geek Speak is a Creative Commons endeavor, share and share alike. That means you can reuse our content for anything you'd like. Join the car guys. What was that, Miles?
As long as you don't make money off of it.
One more time, man.
As long as you don't make money off of it.
No, people can make money off of us.
They can?
Sure. What's the problem? What's the harm?
But they have to... Oh, wait. The restriction is if we share it and you use it, you have to reshare it.
Yes. You have to have the same license as we do. So if you make money off of it, that means you're going to make money off of giving it away, which could be hard, but please feel free to do so. It means you could burn CDs and sell them to friends, or burn CDs and give them to friends.
People would buy us if we put ourselves on a CD.
Some people
I was completely unaware of this.
Some people think so.
If you figure it out, let us know.
Did I mention the car guys are after us? Have I said that yet? I lost track of what I was doing.
Me too.
Join the car guys, click and collect, the Tappet Brothers for advice on things automotive and just about everything else on Car Talk every Sunday at 9 a.m. right here on Central Coast Public Radio. KOSP, they're actually also right after us in about 45 minutes. All right, let's go ahead and start with some Geek Speak news. Mr. Elam, hi. I wasn't here last week, and you were. Thank you for covering the show. It was flawless.
Yeah, except for the theme song. You come in here, you're totally late, you're like rushed for time, and the theme song works wonderfully.
I came in
early, like made sure everything was set up. I was like getting everything, I was like watching all my connections, going, okay, I have the cable going to my laptop. I tested out. You know,
he ran it all
laptop.
By me. He's like,
I made sure
Ben,
I wasn't muted.
Yeah.
I made sure that I was pottered
so what
up.
Was it? What
and
was
I turned
the
it on, had AB on, so it was on the RCA. I have no idea. I think it's because we have old equipment.
It's funny you should mention that. On Thursday, Al and I went down to the Museum of Art History in Santa Cruz, and we participated in a fundraiser called Upgrade 2011. KOSP, you've probably heard a lot of promotions about this, is raising some money right now to repair the board and the systems here at the station. And I did a little presentation about what we'll be replacing. And yes, we will be replacing the board so that the lights work, which will help. And there'll be a lot of other things being replaced. I don't know if you'll still be able to play the theme song, though. One thing we could do is we could take the six or seven theme songs we have and actually put it in the cart system.
Oh, Bluetooth audio would be awesome.
Wait, what do you want to do?
You just like bring your laptop in and you automatically start syncing the Bluetooth audio.
So
and
that's all we need is less clarity on the tech here.
Yeah, once you eliminate the wires, well, there's a whole...
Everything will be fine.
Yeah.
Hey, it's how radio works.
That's right. Miles Elam, software engineer and political junkie. Hi.
Good morning. So here's a curious thing. If you are Catholic... and you want to make a confession, you don't have a church nearby that you can make that confession, there is now an app for that.
Awesome. What? Are you serious?
Yes.
Do you type it or do you say it?
I don't know. I actually haven't used the app. However, it has been officially sanctioned by the Roman Catholic Church for use.
Wow.
It does not replace a traditional in-person confession, but It walks you through the process and suggests you things you may wish to confess. So it's like training confession.
I know about as much about Catholicism as, you know, pop culture dictates by watching television. So I, from my understanding, you go to a confessional, you say the things you've done that there are sins, and then the priest then walks you through how you atone to that. And normally it's prayer and other things. And it could be anything, I'm assuming. But normally, of course, it's Hail Marys is always what's on TV. So this app, basically, you pick your sin. You start with the seven, and then it just goes down.
The Hail Marys you should come up with, I'm sure, with kids, because, you know, their sins tend to be fairly minimal, and it's kind of like you need to, you know, say.
But I gotta know if this app is like a multi-choice thing.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Like I'm kind of
coveting. Okay, neighbor's wife. No. Neighbor's daughter. Okay, coveting. You know, how inappropriate is it? And then finally, it's like, go to jail. Do not press go. I mean, how bad is it?
Do not collect $200.
So we'll have that link up on our website if you want to learn more about how to confess into
how much
an iPhone.
Is the app?
It is $1.99.
Or totally buy it. Thank you very much, Mr.
Because, you know, if you sin, it costs.
But only the first time.
Really?
You buy the app and then you can sin all you want, right?
Yeah, would that be an indulgence?
That'd be awesome. Every time you have a sin path that's like too much, you actually get billed for a new upgrade in the app.
Is there a trademark on the term sin path?
Yeah, once again, this is not meant to replace traditional in-person confessions. But at the same time, it's officially sanctioned by the Roman Catholic Church. You just got to wonder what to make of it.
What's not to love? Thank you. Thank you, Miles. Ben Jaffe, freelance media guy and instructor. Hi.
Hi. How's it going?
Good.
Yeah. I'm kind of envious of your orange juice.
There's Miles, a big, wonderful thing of orange juice.
Is there really?
Yeah.
Are there cups, though?
Well, this cup was brought to me by Charlie, and I really appreciated it.
Okay.
I would share it with you, but I'm sick.
Well, they just walked out the door as I was saying that. Maybe they the did. 10-second delay, they'll hear that I want
What's
orange
What's your
juice.
New story, sir?
My new story. So, you guys remember back in Windows 95 when Microsoft was like, hey, if you put in a CD with something called autorun.exe or .ini
sure.
or any kind of INF, executable file, INF, excuse me, thank you, it'll automatically run that code. And some people were like, hooray, that's awesome. We can make digital picture frames. So, you know, give a CD to your grandma. She puts it in the computer and it pops up and there's, you know, you don't have to do a thing.
What could possibly go wrong?
Well, security professionals were pretty frustrated by this. And, this has been an attack vector for years and years and years.
Here's a real basic scenario. Kevin Mitnick, a famous hacker, when he was on the show, talked about this in his book. You take a CD, you put a virus on it that infects a machine and does all these nasty things, a rootkit for you and stuff. Then you write on it, salaries, 2011 salaries, and you drop it in an elevator to company. And any employee that picks it up will either go, ooh, I want to know what salaries are, and they put it in their computer, or they're going to give it to HR, and HR is going to be like, what's this about, and put it in the computer.
Mm-hmm.
So basically,
it's an easy way to get into a network.
It's really easy.
And the other thing is, it's not just CDs and DVDs. It's also USB sticks, which is, you know, just as bad, if not worse, right? Because, how much space does a USB stick have, and how easy are they to drop in inconspicuous or in, you know, not quite conspicuous places, and people will find them? I mean, probably better than a CD. You know, someone sees a CD, they might just be like, oh, a CD, or this custodian might just toss it, right?
Right.
Yeah, but think of the timing, though. It's like with a USB drive, it's just like, boom, you're in. A CD, it's like, hit the eject button, wait for the tray to come out, put the CD in. It means you have, with a CD, you have an extra 6 seconds to rethink your your decision to put this thing you don't know about in.
Yeah, bad news.
USB, no warning.
So Microsoft has finally decided, you know what, maybe this feature that we introduced with Windows 95 is not such a great idea, you know? So however many years later, they pushed out a Windows update that will stop auto run exploits because it pretty much disables the feature. Now, in the past, let's say you were concerned about auto run, it was actually really difficult to disable. Like in Windows 95, Windows 98, it was really difficult to disable that thing. Like you'd have to, you know, maybe go into the registry or figure out how to do it. It wasn't like a setting somewhere.
Right.
Microsoft pushed this update. They didn't call it a security update, interestingly enough. They called it an important non-security update, which is kind of interesting. Maybe there's a little bit of hubris or pride, like not wanting to say, oh yeah, we were wrong for implementing this feature.
So
for,
I have a question.
For
just
however many
now,
years.
Implementing an easy
just now.
Return.
Yeah, I have a question. Were you even alive when Windows 95 came out then?
No. I was not quite a twinkle in my parents' eyes.
The auto run feature.
I was born in 97.
Do you recall the audio CD that had a little bit of a rootkit on it? Was that Sony? Do you remember this, Miles? So they're
Sony
produces a whole bunch of audio music, right? And CDs have recording artists on CD, and they installed this thing that would restrict people from copying the CDs onto their computer. This is earlier, before people understood that it's not as bad as you think. And they actually installed a rootkit using the auto-run feature from a CD. And the CD just looks like an audio CD.
Yeah.
And it happens to have a whole sector on it that installs a rootkit on your machine, stopping you from being able to copy CDs.
Oof.
Just nasty stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was basically all Sony CDs from like 2002 to 2004.
Yeah.
And the ends don't justify the means, even
right,
if they were
right.
And
some of the software on there, of course, was had licenses on it that said they had to, you know, publish the license, had to make the source code available,
and
broke rules too.
It opened up a security hole for other people to
get in. That's right.
To get in, yeah. And you had the head of Sony that was responsible for this, or that department that was responsible for this, saying, "Well, most people don't even know what a rootkit is. So what's the big deal?
What is a rootkit?
Rootkit is something that patches the kernel or the basic libraries of a system. So
the operating system of your computer, it kind of puts itself inside the computer system.
So it's something that, because it becomes part of the base operating system, the operating system has been compromised and cannot even detect it anymore.
Right.
It's kind of like with a virus, you know, your antivirus will be able to say, like, oh, hey, there's a virus there.
Some weird code running, you know. Whatever.
Right, that type of thing.
But
because
this actually
it's running on top of the operating system.
But this actually modifies the operating system.
Right, and so you could have it where Windows Explorer, like from the kernel point of view, it's asking like, hey, what files are in this directory? And the rootkit goes, oh, well, let me intercept that call. Okay, you have all, oh, wait, this is where I am, so I'm not going to tell you that I'm here.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Also, if anyone remembers the Conficker worm, the really, really bad one from, I don't know how long, a year ago maybe, a year and a half ago? Really horrible bug. And I, yeah, right. I am in my teens, actually. But,
okay.
But yeah, that was a really bad one. I remember just there were stories that that I wanted to cover and Alex wanted to cover and Miles was covering for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks about that particular one. That one also exploited this. So like this is a pretty bad attack vector, and it's really nice to hear that Microsoft is making
so Microsoft's finally patching this virus vector called Auto Exec
Auto
Run.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Elam. I don't know what your next news story is, but I'm sure it's fascinating.
Well, I'm really debating which one to do because they're all so interesting. But I was wondering whether to go positive or negative, and unfortunately, I think I'm going to go negative.
Typical.
Right. The U.S. House of Representatives, the current group that's in there, have a list of proposed spending cuts for the U.S. federal government. Right now, we are running a very large deficit. It is something to worry about. The cuts, however, seem to hit very strongly with NASA, NOAA, Oceanic Atmospheric Association.
I'll go with that.
Nuclear energy research, fossil fuel energy research, CDC, National Institutes of Health, various Environmental Protection Act affiliates. And at the same time, there aren't really any cuts to the things that are actually the largest parts of the budget, which are the Defense Department and Social Security. And it's kind of like, oh, yeah, we're cutting all of these science programs and ways to gather knowledge.
Which is only a small percent of the money.
Right, which is an infinitesimal part of the money. I mean, compared to the others, it really doesn't make a difference. Like, you could completely abolish or dissolve NASA, NOAA, National Institutes of Health, CDC, and we still wouldn't be anywhere really closer to...
Right. But it's not things that people care about as much, and that's why they're targeted?
Well, I care about the things, like... They're also having proposed cuts for or defunding NPR and PBS. So from a personal standpoint, yeah, it's an issue. But I guess just from a science standpoint, the idea of like choosing this one thing, one from a number standpoint, it's like that doesn't seem to work out. But also from an ideological standpoint of this, because I am a geek going, wait, you're cutting all of these science programs. But why?
Because people don't complain when they're cut. I mean, I guess that's why.
I guess the...
So you're complaining officially.
I am complaining officially, right. And I think more people that do have
don't
some background in science, not necessarily a formal science education, but you know enough to be able to speak to it that you know the recognize the value of it to be able to complain about it. But yeah.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Miles Elam.
I'll throw my hat on that ring, too.
Yeah? You'll complain?
Yeah. I'm not sure what I wasn't listening, but...
What's your next news story, sir?
So this is an interesting one. According to a press release by CISCON, they're an IT, the press release is about an IT security expert, Avira, which is a company, and they did a consumer security survey, but instead of just doing a normal security survey, they kind of had fun with this one in December, and they asked people, have you ever cursed or yelled at your computer out loud? Have you ever wished for a catastrophe to strike the company that makes your operating system or software or computer? Things like that. And some of the results were really very funny. They found that 39% of people had cursed or yelled at their computer out loud. Now, that seems like a really low number. And 38% said, no, I would never yell at my computer. It's too sensitive, was the wording of the question.
How many people answered that way?
That was 38%, just 1% less. 11% said they wished for a catastrophe to strike the company that makes their operating system software or computer. 9% have hit their computer with another object. And in the parentheses, it says another object, fist, baseball bat, etc. And then 3% have, quote, actually thrown the computer to the ground or against a desk or other piece of furniture.
Nice.
So that's pretty intense. Now, here's the catch with that. I was thinking, yeah, 39% seems really low, but the press release seems pretty, it's pretty clear in saying that that's like, you know, 40%, almost 40% of the people have yelled at their computers, the kinds of things they were saying. But when you add up all of these percentages, they mysteriously add up to 100%. So my thinking is they told the people who were taking the survey, choose one. And so I'm not really sure if that's actually the case. Maybe it's just coincidence that they happen to add up to 100%. But you know, typically you would assume that someone who cursed or yelled at the, or sorry, someone who hit their computer with another object probably has also cursed at it. And so you probably would get more than 100% adding these up together. So given that finding, the results are a little bit less, less useful, but very interesting to think that probably around 3% have thrown their computer to the ground or against a desk or a piece of furniture out the window, office space style. That's kind of cool.
Nice.
This brings up two points for me. One, I can't remember where I saw it, but there was research that cursing or putting up some utterance actually reduces stress and reduces pain. Like, for example, when checking to see how much something hurt, if you went, or something I can't say on the radio, it actually hurt less, and it didn't affect you as badly as if you just kept it all in and just bottled it up.
So it's not an objective, measurable, like objectively measurable thing necessarily. Let me rephrase what I was saying. Pain is very subjective, is what I was trying to say.
The other thing is people talk about, oh, those computer manufacturers are out there wanting us to buy new computers when we don't need them. This one's perfectly good, and they want us to buy a new one every 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. Well, this leads credence to it's not our fault. This isn't the geek's fault. This is people are hitting their computer. With that type of abuse, how long do you really expect them to last?
That is a very good point.
When you're doing tech support, if you've got a really serious problem, you have to remember that there's a percentage of people that actually torture their computers. So keep in mind that could be the problem.
Actually,
and if you waterboard it, yeah, you need to buy another one to atone right away.
In that vein, there was a comment actually to an article that linked to the press release I was just reading from that said, this is an anonymous comment, said, a different study, University of Maryland, I think, enumerated various ways in which computer users admitted to acting out their frustrations on their computer. My personal top favorite is shooting it with a gun. So apparently in these studies, some people have actually admitted to getting frustrated with the computer and shooting it with a gun. And that's not like, you know, I'm angry at my computer, I'll like hit it on the side of the monitor or something like that. It's like, I will destroy my computer because it's making
that,
me upset.
That ranks up there with the people that give death threat, propose death threats to weathermen.
Like, because yeah.
It happens all the time. Seriously, people who do the weather get death threats on
Miles, why are people so stupid?
as though the person doing the weather on TV has any say whatsoever about whether it rains or not.
Like, I love the idea that you're sitting home, you get your jet ski and you're ready to go to the lake, and the weatherman says it's going to rain this weekend. You go, you're gonna die.
You have people saying, like, calling up, being angry, saying, "Say it's going to be sunny, or you're gonna get it." Like,
that's magical thinking right there.
Miles, next news story. Sir.
So I did a downer before. Now I'm gonna do an upper. The Khan Academy is and I'm going to put the link up on the website to
Khan?
For later. Khan, K-H-A-N,
as in Khan.
is a website that has more than 2,000 videos, covers high school and college level curriculum like science, math, history, finance, test preparation. It's an amazing resource. I've talked about it about a year and a half ago, okay, something like that, when it was first launched. And it is absolutely wonderful. Everything is open license with Creative Commons.
They're all free. These are people that are making the amazing textbooks.
Yes.
Right.
And I highly recommend them. They're a wonderful resource. Well, they have hooked up with BitTorrent Incorporated, which is the company founded by the guy who invented the BitTorrent protocol.
And the BitTorrent protocol is a peer-to-peer, meaning I share something and other people can share from me. We don't actually host it anywhere. And it also has a great feature of technology which allows for quicker downloads of files.
Right. At least quicker downloads because you're not limited by that single source. People who don't have quite as much bandwidth can get away.
We've talked about it before. BitTorrent is a really amazing technology that allows for sharing content. But go on.
Right. And BitTorrent is commonly associated with file sharing movies and videos where people usually hear like torrents or BitTorrent.
Right.
BitTorrent, it has nothing to do with the content it's transmitting. It's merely the ability to transfer content in a peer-to-peer network.
When people attack BitTorrent, it's like attacking the freeway system because there happens to be people that are criminals using it. There's no relation to the technology.
That's a really great analogy. Well, they've teamed up with BitTorrent, so there's a partnership between them to distribute the open education videos over a BitTorrent network.
Mm-hmm.
And in such a way that you know when you go to Khan Academy and you go to, you know, BitTorrent, that these things are the legitimate thing. One thing that's been an issue with regard to downloading music programs that you haven't paid for is that you may end up with a virus on your system or something like that. This allows some accountability because you know where the source is.
Mm-hmm.
And every torrent has a unique key to it. It's an amazing thing. It gets those videos out there, and I can't stress enough how wonderful a resource it is for people to get out there and use it and on your own time. You don't have to enroll back into college or, you know,
It's a good thing?
Yes, it's a very good thing.
All right, thank
That's
you.
That's actually very cool. Maybe people might actually also be educated about BitTorrent not being the illegal thing, but kind of, you know, with the metaphor that you gave, right, of being similar to the freeway system that some bad people might use it. Not just getting educational material through BitTorrent, but maybe also being educated about BitTorrent. And yeah, could be cool.
Cool. Thank you very much, guys, for the geek news. We might go right back to the geek news because I'm not sure if we have a connection with our guest. I want to mention that you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. This is Geek Speak. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence. We thank him for the use of the name. We are now going to join. Joining us now is David Eric Nelson. And David, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So David's new book is Snip, Burn, Solder, Shred, serious geeky stuff to make with your kids. It's kind of a how-to on a whole bunch of making stuff. We're going to talk about going through that, but first I want to mention that David Eric Nelson is a freelance writer and former high school teacher. His fiction has been nominated for Nebula Award and has appeared in Asimov's Science Fiction, The Best of Lady Churchill's Rosebud Whistler, and the forthcoming Steampunk Reloaded anthology. He developed the project in this book at an alternative school with plenty of feedback from his students. He's a contributor to Ask the Giant Squid advice column at Poor Mojo's Almanac, a weekly online literary journal. And David, actually, that's one of the things I want to mention right off about this book. I've seen a lot of these how-to creative kind of making books, and when they're written well, they are so much more enjoyable. And I got to say, this is written really well. It's a good read, even if you're not going to do the projects. First off, tell me about the school that you developed this book in.
Well, I live in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it was a little, tiny, private alternative school. And alternative education has sort of shifted in meaning in about the last 10 years, and it's become the term we use for schools where we dump problems kids as part of the public education system.
Right.
And that's one part of it, because a lot of kids who have problems in conventional schools have problems for valid reasons. You know, they have a learning style that, you know, it's not a learning disability, but it's simply a difference that doesn't mesh well with a really large public institution that has a very set of strict goals yep. that, you know, you need to match in a regular process. And so that kind of older, kind of out of the 1960s, 1970s meaning of alternative education is what this school was founded under. And so it was entirely democratically operated, meaning that the students and the staff had equal say in how we ran programs, how we resolved problems. Well, students, staff, and parents, of mm-hmm. course, so families and staff, how we resolved problems, how we set curriculum, how we evaluated curriculum. So it was a lot of negotiating.
and how, I mean, out of those schools, the students that have moved on, how have they done in college and in life?
You know, it's funny, they do really remarkably well, and especially because, and you know, I started by saying that this wasn't specifically a school for troubled children, although functionally speaking, if you're running a private alternative school, you get a lot of students who have had substance abuse problems, who have been institutionalized because of the strain of trying to function within this system that they really couldn't work within. So taking that on the way in, that a lot of students, when I met them, had drug problems, had psychological problems.
Sure.
An abnormally high number went on to First Community College and then to springboard that into like a four-year university, which is more cost-effective and something we actually encouraged. Like right off the top of my head, I can think of students who are, you know, God forbid, graduate students now. students who are recording engineers, students who are working musicians.
That makes sense.
One of my former students works for Gawker.
it makes sense you would have musicians coming out, because I mean, if some of your students went through that, what's in this book, they're definitely getting a feel for electronics and for music generation. So let's talk a little bit about this. The book has, I don't know, this thing like 30 different projects. And we're going to just kind of talk about a few of the projects and get people a feel for it. Can you tell us about Switchbox? It's in the earlier part of the book.
Part of the sort of development of the book is my own son is 4 years old now. Mm-hmm. And so when I started writing the book, he was 2 years old. And I don't know if you have kids, but
sure,
that's the beginning of a very active phase that goes with a young, you know, with a boy child, like it starts at two and goes until I would say the 20s or 30s, where they're very hands-on learners.
Yeah.
and so that was kind of something I put together because I wanted to include a few projects that would be fun for toddlers too, because I had a toddler wandering around.
Wait, this is soldering. So is that a toddler? I was thinking about,
as a project for something for him to play with.
good.
Ultimately. Yeah, he's not allowed to solder. Mom has rules.
Yeah, soldering's a pretty dangerous thing. But yeah. you built this box. So this is a box with a whole bunch of switches and LEDs and also a buzzer. And depending on how you switch the patterns, you get sounds out of it and effects. And definitely a cool toy for a kid. But fun to make, too, I'm assuming.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of part of the split of the book. I have a dear friend, one of the co-authors of the Ask the Giant Squid column, is a guy named Fritz Swanson. And we used to build stuff together, electronics projects. And we always got kind of caught up in that basic Steve Wozniak versus Steve Jobs argument, where I always felt like the fun part was building it, and he always thought the fun part was using it at the end. And so right. All these projects kind of have both halves of that. like the Switchbox is a great beginning soldering project. These are pretty robust pieces that you're not likely to break, even if you're new to soldering. But you certainly can if you're totally, totally screwing up soldering.
Right.
You will melt an LED. You will know you're doing something wrong. So it's a project that, you know, an adult who's new to soldering and is nervous about doing it, which I find a lot of adults are, and kids who are usually gung-ho but, you know, aren't necessarily the carefulest people in the world, this is a great project to get you started building. And at the end, you've got something that's really neat for little kids to play with and explore.
Yeah, you have a great phrase on what it creates afterwards. Oh man, I can't find it now. But the idea that it becomes the spaceship the spaceship interactive tool, you know, the 4-year-old's going to play with it in ways that you wouldn't even think. I want to have you get a reading done. If you go ahead and do the silk screen or the screening on, I think it's page 49. Would you read that introduction to us?
Certainly. Project number 5, cheap mesh screen printing. Invented in China roughly 2,000 years ago, silkscreen printing is the cheapest, most pleasing way to directly reproduce images and designs. A screen, once silk, now usually polyester, but in all cases permeable to ink, is stretched over a wooden frame, and screen filler is applied to all portions of the screen that are not part of the intended design, forming a stencil. The Chinese used to do this by weaving human hairs into the screen in order to make portions impermeable. Once the filler is dried, you apply ink to the screen and pull the ink across the open design with a squeegee, flooding the mesh and pressing ink through onto your substrate, which is usually paper or cloth. You then repeat this process, adding more ink as necessary. Using this technique, hundreds of copies of a single design can be more or less perfectly reproduced in about an hour.
And the supplies for this one are pretty simple. You want to walk us through them a little bit?
You've
got an embroidery certainly. Hoop, which everyone's familiar with, a piece of bamboo with another piece of bamboo around it that you can stretch fabric on for embroidery yep. normally. And what's the fabric that you used in this?
I used nylon tulle, which is super, super common. You make bridal veils out of it and those little fluffy centerpieces. You can buy it at like most any craft store for $2 for, I think, a quadrillion yards of it.
Yeah, and it looks like a screen.
You get a ton of it in a bag.
If you look mm-hmm. real close at it, it's like screen type material, right?
I'm sorry, how much is a quadrillion? What was the number you gave?
I think I said it was a quadrillion yards. I'll stand by that number, too.
Okay.
It's tulle is kind of nice because it's a finer mesh than like a screen on a screen door. But it's not quite so fine as what you use in like a professional screen printing environment. So it's a little more forgiving, and the end result's going to be a little blockier and lo-fi and look kind of like Super Mario,
yeah.
which is an aesthetic I happen to like.
Yeah, and if you're using a real thin silk, you have a problem with the ink actually filling the gaps, and your screen has to be cleaned continually, which mm-hmm. of course no one likes the cleaning part. And what are you using as the blocking material for this project?
I'm using regular old Elmer's glue, which works great. Mod Podge, which is like a kind of glue varnish that
Elmer
you use
glue
doing,
on steroids.
Yeah,
it's,
exactly.
It's
works
basically
awesome.
Mod Podge is basically matte medium. I think that it's a cheaper type.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's basically like the filler. It's the part of the paint that's that is the glue part,
mm-hmm.
if you will.
And you can also use like gesso, which painters use to prepare screens. Again, a lot of these projects have a lot of flex to them.
Mm-hmm.
You can swap out ingredients that are harder for you to get for things that are easier easier to fabricate.
One of the things I like about this project is since it's a screen type material, the tool is transparent. You find an image that you like, some kind of, you know, blocky kind of image, if you will. You put that mm-hmm. material down, you take a Sharpie and you trace out where you're going to write. Of course, probably going through the tool and damaging the thing you're copying, but who cares?
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, you just kind of paint the part with Elmer's glue or Mod Podge, whatever, the part that you don't want ink to go onto. And after, I would say, this project's probably, what, about an hour completely? You've got this thing that you can reproduce images on shirts or walls of the room, right?
Yeah,
anywhere you
I
want.
Mean, and it's a good leg up because then, you know, you spent really money-wise next to nothing to see, like, oh, I really do like screen printing. This is cool. And so it's a lot easier to justify, you know, dropping $20 and doing like a photo emulsion set, which allows you to get much higher resolution and like take actual photo images and adapt them to a screen.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, kind of the narrow edge of the crafting wedge.
Yeah. we are talking with David Eric Nelson. He's in Ann Arbor, Michigan. His book is Snip, Burn, Solder, Shred, Seriously Geeky Stuff to Make with Your Kids. I assure you, you don't have to have kids to enjoy this book. In fact, you can have... you could do it for yourself. Pretty much all this stuff, I'd have a fun time without my kids. And some of these things, of course, soldering and all that, the making part of it's fun for you, and you could give the item away to the kids. I got to say that the silkscreen thing, perfect for Valentine's Day. It's coming up, right? You could go ahead and make mm-hmm. all your Valentine's cards using this process. Some of the stuff that you're, I saw a great presentation yesterday. Have you heard a great presentation where you walk through making a one string electric guitar, which is one of the items in this book. And that whole presentation on how to do that is actually on O'Reilly. We'll have it linked up from geekspeak.org. Can you tell us a little bit about making, what's the one string guitar called?
It's this one string electric guitar. It's adapted from a diddly bow, which is a traditional African American folk instrument. That's totally improvised. They're usually made out of like baling wire and a jar and an old board. But I mean, that's the diddly bow is the basis of blues guitar and of like slide blues guitar. So it's one of those kind of funny things where it's sort of a bunch of junks and scrap put together, but it's also the cornerstone of our music culture, which is like one of the most important exports the United States still has.
So do you have one with you? Can you play it?
I do indeed have mine sitting behind me here. There we are. So this
is $10 worth of parts and an afternoon.
And I'm going to come legit here. That $10 is a highball estimate.
Yeah.
Again, a lot of
if you want the fancy model.
Yeah, this is you know, the Stratocaster. So here's kind of the sound you're going to get for $10 and like an afternoon of sawing and winding wire around stuff. So I don't know. I'm not much of a guitarist. But I think we can all agree that that sounds suitably guitar-like for
Definitely.
What is a cookie tin bolted to a stick.
Now, you actually made your pickup, which is essential on this because you're not doing acoustic guitar. It doesn't have a resonance body. You actually mm-hmm. instead are using a small magnetic with wire that is like a traditional electric guitar pickup. Can you tell us a little bit about making that? And I mean, it seems very, your instructions seem very sloppy, but highly functional. Why does it work so well?
Sort of a leitmotif that goes through this book is that a lot of traditional ways of doing things that were a bit more labor intensive in the past continue to be highly functional and are a lot easier now because we have access to better stuff. Like a standard guitar pickup, just in case listeners aren't in the know, is you've got a magnet and you've got a bunch of very thin copper wire wrapped around it. And as that magnetic guitar string vibrates over it, it perturbs the magnetic field, which pushes and pulls a current through the wire. It's a real basic design. You know, it's what, 50, 60, 70 years or so we've been making guitars.
And all you have to do is put an amplifier to the small disturbance that gets produced by mm-hmm. the string, and then you get the electric guitar sound.
Exactly. But the thing is, these were a little more labor intensive to make because you know, we used to be stuck with just kind of, you know, regular kitchen grade magnets, but now neodymium magnets, which are like sold as super magnets and you see in every hardware store now,
those really
are readily
small, powerful
available.
Magnets. Yeah.
And they're so much more powerful that it allows you to use that old design and, you don't need nearly as many windings. It's not nearly as labor intensive to build, and it's not nearly as sensitive anymore.
Yeah, and so it used to be that the magnet was weaker, and you therefore would have to have 6,000 or 7,000 turns of wire, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. really, you got to have thin wire and really close to the magnet. So really, really thin wire. It's copper wire that's really thin, and then on top of that, say insulator that's also very thin, and you have to wind that, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 times, which to anybody sounds kind of daunting. But now it's more like 1,500 times. Which is something you can do in front of watching a YouTube video.
Exactly. I really stress that like 1,500 windings is going to take under 30 minutes.
Yeah.
It's really easy. And I know people that, like the test reader for the book, a guy named Tom Clark, he wound his pickup in a couple of minutes by sticking it on the hub of his sewing machine.
Nice.
And just zipping it right up
just
there.
Like
and again, the 1,500 windings was a total guesstimate on his part, and his came out.
And the cool thing about this instrument, of course, it's only got one string, so it doesn't have to be paired to anything. You just have to have some kind of pickup. You're not mm-hmm. making six of them, and therefore you're going to have them all tuned up, you know, comparable in volume, or you're going to have different levels of volume, basically, for each string. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that I noticed in your book in general, when you want a small circle for this thing, you need the spool aspect to wind around. You actually use a traditional playing card bicycle circle. Mm-hmm. And the bicycle cards, if everyone's familiar with that, that design has a wheel on the front of it. And that wheel happens to be the same circle for, I don't know, a few of your projects. I keep seeing it. Why doing it that way? Why aren't you just telling people to make a 1-inch diameter circle?
I went with the bike playing card because that's what I had handy. It's a terrible answer. But no, these are the things that are in front of me. And I really encourage people to, like, these are the things that are in front of you. You know, adapt what you have handy to the thing that you want to make. And you'll be shocked how often it works and works just fine.
We are speaking with David Eric Nelson. He's in Michigan. His book is Snip, Burn, Solder, Shred. You can learn more about it from geekspeak.org. The geeks today are Miles Elam. Hey, Miles.
Hey.
Ben Jaffe.
Hello.
I'm Lyle Troxell. We aren't taking calls today just because Rick's on vacation, but we are online. You can ask us questions through email, but of course you can also chat with us on IRC. You can learn about that from going to geekspeak.org. All right, so one of the things you're doing is you're making the didgeridoo an electric didgeridoo, which sounds awesome. In this one, you're assuming you're using a speaker or a microphone, not a pickup, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, the one thing I noticed about it is you're suggesting people take a blowtorch to PVC. Not so good in some senses, but the warning I thought was nice. Never heat PVC indoors. Always wear a carbon filter respirator capable of filtering organic chemicals while molding. PVC. When heated, PVC releases chlorine, which is true. This is why I'd suggest not heating PVC. But of course, you're not burning, you're heating, which is good. But mm-hmm. This is to get that traditional shape of a didgeridoo where it has some gnarliness to it. Is that essential to make a good sounding didgeridoo? Can't you just have a straight tube?
You can have just a straight tube and get a decent sound, especially if you kind of move up in diameter a little, because mm-hmm. then you're going to be setting up your standing wave in a larger volume of air. The thing is that's a real total pain to play. The reason we're kind of gnarling this up is we need to increase the back pressure, because like what makes the didgeridoo cool is that you get those long droning tones because you're for lack of a better term, you're making a fart noise with your lips. You're right. Making the Bronx cheer, and you're holding that, and you can hold that because you've got some back pressure. Like there's a trumpet player can do the same thing because, you know, it's not just his lips flapping all over the place and wasting the energy.
Right. There's a long tube that you got to push the air through, and that friction is causing you more pressure, and therefore you can make the sound for longer.
Exactly. And so we're gnarling it up in order to increase the back pressure, and it also makes it a lot easier to kind of move up and down from that fundamental tone. Like if you just want like a didgeridoo noise, make a raspberry in a tube and you're going to get it. But if you actually want to be able to do more with it musically, you know, get those overtones and start getting those effects, that's going to be a lot harder if you have no back pressure, because it's just like spitting right into the wind.
Yeah, and you're talking about the multiple different frequencies that will harmonate in that tube. Mm-hmm. You need fine granularity, if you will, of your mouth to be able to change your
exactly.
octave or your note. Okay, very cool. And so let's see. I want to get through a couple more. Since we talked about the guitar that you have, electric guitar, of course, the electric guitar sound is highly known to us from all the different things you can do to the sound. So mm-hmm. stomp pedals, different type of amplifier stack, all of these things cause a different quality in the sound. If you talk to an electric guitar person, they will talk your ear off about the sounds they like. Each song you hear, when you hear a guitar really, you know, sing, you're hearing all the different sound effects of it. And in this book, you've got a whole section on making different stomp boxes, things that modify the sound. Can you talk to us? Can you actually read 197, the introduction to Dirt Cheap? Well, go ahead, if you wouldn't mind. 197.
Certainly. Project number 16, Dirt Cheap Boutique Stomp Boxes, the 2-transistor fuzz tone. And just as a, to put people in the know again, guitarists love to like have their own unique special sound to really mold that sound, because when you spend hours and hours and hours practicing guitar, you get sick of hearing just what your guitar sounds like. It becomes way overly familiar. It's Ritz crackers every day. So a lot of times folks will invent in what are called boutique stomp boxes. These are very limited run stomp boxes made by little shops or individuals, sometimes unique one-offs. And they're, you know, kind of interesting flange sounds, phases, distortions that are indeed unique. And guitarists, I know people have dropped hundreds of dollars, $300-$400 on a single stomp box. And it's got a really interesting, cool sound, but a lot of times there's actually really simple circuits at the heart of those that you can build yourself for just a few bucks and get a sound that you're going to like.
And these are called stomp boxes because in the music industry, normally you since your hands are busy with the guitar, you normally mm-hmm. have a foot pedal that you would turn this on and off so you can mm-hmm. add the sound to your feed, if you will, of your guitar. And yep. Yeah, go ahead.
So project number 16, Dirt Cheap Boutique Stomp Boxes, the 2-transistor fuzz tone. The last of our Dirt Cheap Boutique Stomp Boxes is the 2-transistor fuzz tone. This is a dirty, rudimentary amplifier where one transistor overdrives another and the resulting signal is asymmetrically clipped by a set of diodes. There's a footnote here that I'm just going to hit that explains clipping. Think of an audio signal as a wave. The diode in the circuit clip off the peaks and valleys of that wave, converting the smooth, rolling hills of a natural S-curve into a series of mesas, sloppy square waves. The resulting sound in various contexts is called distortion or fuzz. The result is a thick, aggressive, Hendrix-esque tone with greatly increased sustain and sensitivity. This design is based on T. Escobedo's adaptation of Christian Holmberg's venerable Baz fuzz tone box, which you can find designs for all over online. Lots of guys make lots of different fuzz tones. Like any boutique effect worth its salt, both the Blinky tremolo from the previous project, which is a tremolo box, and the 2-transistor fuzz tone have true bypass switches, so you can bring the effects in and out of the effects chain without having to unplug everything and with no signal degradation, which actually makes this design a little bit better than a lot of stuff you buy at the store, which doesn't use true bypass. And so if you just have it plugged in but don't have the effect on, it kind of muffles the tone of your instrument, which is annoying.
So your one the guitar we heard you play earlier, I'm assuming it's going through one of these boxes. Can you go ahead and play a little bit and then turn this fuzz tone on?
Yep. So here's just our straight signal. And I'm going to bring in the fuzz tone now. And incidentally, that's just set at about 1/3. So I'm just going to crank it up to 11 here.
Fantastic.
So that's, and incidentally, that's like really a buck and a half worth of parts, an Anavolt battery, and a couple of guitar jacks. Like
I think it's worth
circuit real cheap.
I think it's worth twice that much considering the Spinal Tap reference.
Yeah, at least.
You definitely had it up to 11, huh? Well, very cool. This book is full of projects like this, making your own electric guitar sounds, generators. You even have some robots in here. You want to talk to us a little bit about the jitterbug?
gosh, the jitterbug. What's to say about it? I actually really, really love the jitterbug. It's a very simplistic, photophobic robot. So when light hits it, it freaks out and it starts jittering and shaking and moving around until it stumbles out of the light again, at which time it calms back down. And frankly, if you're an evolution fan, which I myself am, you know that this is kind of how the human eye, you know, this is what it evolved from, single cell organisms that pretty much behave the same way. Light hit them and they freaked out and got away from it. And that's kind of the beginning of vision. This is a design that, as I worked on it and built it, got really, really stripped down to just its bare knuckle components. It's just like a transistor, one resistor, a photoresistor, a battery, and a little vibrator motor that you can pull out of a dead cell phone or a beeper, or even buy new for just a couple of bucks. And it's just sort of a great introduction, I mean, to the idea of beam robotics, which are real minimal. Yes?
Yeah. The general thing here is you make a circuit that has a light sensor on it. And if that sensor is seeing light, it turns on the circuit and vibrates a motor. And if you make this thing small with kind of low friction bottom, some ball bearings, if you will, and you put that on the ground on a table surface, whatever, as light happens, it starts to vibrate around, and what will happen is it's going to move completely randomly based on where it's vibrating. It just kind of bounces around. And as it finally finds a place where there's no light, the circuit turns off and it stops. So really, it really is this little robot that's going to go find a dark corner. It's kind of creepy and kind of sad. But what a great little project. Really simple to make. I've seen these things as kits you normally can buy. I love that you're finding the parts, you're scrounging them. Everyone's got the old dead cell phone that's 4 generations back. And if that cell phone ever vibrated when it was on silent mode or everything, it actually has a little tiny motor in there with a counterbalanced rotating disc, which when mm-hmm. it spins, it vibrates. That's the only reason. And that's all you need for your mobile part of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One of the other projects I love, because I actually have a kid that loves Ponyo, is the putt-putt boat. If anyone's familiar with Ponyo, the little fish Japanese, you know, the Japanese animation?
Yeah.
You know how Ponyo, when she turns into a little girl, she takes a little toy boat that puts around and she enlarges it and they ride in this boat?
Yeah.
In this book, it's how to make one of those boats, which is really awesome. You're using a milk carton as the boat itself, and then it's just a coil of a tubed kind of coil, so a tube with in a coil mode over something burning. Why is it that this thing actually produces momentum? How does it work?
This is awesome. This kind of engine is called a flash boiler, for kind of obvious reasons, because the water inside of it boils in a flash. What we have is a real narrow gauge, thin copper tube, which incidentally is also easier to work with if you're spinning a coil. As the tube gets wider, it's going to want to kind of crunch in on itself and crimp more, which is totally frustrating.
Right.
So this is nice and easy to coil up too. So you have this coil of copper tubing that has kind of, think of two pipes coming out the back and they go into a coil. You fill that tube with water and then put it down in the bathtub or the sink, and get your heat going underneath it. I use just a cotton ball soaked in alcohol. And very quickly the water in the coil boils and it needs to expand and it wants to get out of that tube somehow. And so it squirts out of one of those two rear exhaust tubes. But because that fluid's being pulled out, it's pulling fresh cold water in the other tube. And so you get this cycle going where new water is being brought in and the hot water is being blown out. And it's going to keep going like that. And that's going to give you forward thrust. The flash boiler is like one of those things. It was hugely popular like in the late 1800s and early 1900s. People were positive they were going to find a way to make a vehicle run on one of these things. And it like there were airplanes. I mentioned that in the project. I'm not making that up. There were airplanes that used flash boilers to run their props, which is great. You know, you can get them going quick. You don't need to build up a head of steam. The problem is that if they spring any sort of leak or if they just have even a tiny leak that is allowing vapor to escape, they run dry really abruptly, right. Which is so uncool if you're in an airplane.
anything abrupt in an airplane is wrong.
Cruising above the Atlantic. And you like the early like Stanley steamer kind of cars also use flash boilers. And it's just, I guess that's what I really, really love about it, is that it's so simple and easy to build. And it's such a technological dead end. It just won't scale. And that's just like kind of the beautiful thing about it. And there's something so magical about a tiny steamboat.
Yeah, it's really fantastic. It's one of the ones we'll be making with our kids. David, thank you so much for joining us on Geek Speak today. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Was there anything you want to talk about making the book? Any kind of closing remarks you'd like to make? I know I'm just kind of springing that on you, aren't I?
Wow, you did totally spring that
first
on
off, me. You have a blog and you're continually kind of updating stuff about the book around the blog. We'll have that up on geekspeak.org. David Eric Nelson is the author of Snip, Burn, Solder, Shred, Seriously Geeky Stuff to Make with Your Kids or by Yourself. David, thank you so much for being on Geek Speak today, and thank you for the book. Really awesome book.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you.
All right. I don't think today we did a geek bit. Either of you have a geek bit real quick? Miles?
Firefox, whatever number we're at, beta is now out. Firefox 4 beta is out, and IE9 just released its release candidate. Yesterday. So you can download both of those and try them out. It's kind of cool.
And although we didn't cover it before, about 2 weeks ago, we officially ran out of IPv4 addresses from the IANA. And by July, the regional carriers will have lost depleted their pool of IPv4.
This means we're running out of numbers for the internet. It's kind of serious.
Which means we need to move to IPv6. Right. It's no longer, it's going to happen someday. It happened.
It happened. And we're not on track. We're late. We're not doing well.
We are very late.
I want to mention that this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kusp.org. Everything on geekspeak.org that we talk about on the show, we put up on our website, geekspeak.org. You can find out more about David's book, Snip, Burn, Solder, Shred.